This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents A Dance with Dragons, Book 5 of A Song of Ice and Fire, by George R. R. Martin, read for you by Roy Dotrice.
Prologue. The night was rank with the smell of man. The warg stopped beneath a tree and sniffed, his grey-brown fur dappled by shadow. A sigh of piney wind brought the man-scent to him. Over a fainter smells that spoke of fox and hare, seal and stag, even wolf. Those were man-smells, too, the warg knew. The stink of old skins, dead and sour, ne'er drowned beneath the stronger scents of smoke and blood and rot. Only man stripped the skins from other beasts and wore their hides and hair. Wargs have no fear of man as wolves do. Hate and hunger coiled in his belly, and he gave a low growl, calling to his one-eyed brother, to his small, sly sister. As he raced through the trees, his packmates followed hard on his heels. They had caught the scent as well. As he ran, he saw through their eyes, too, and glimpsed himself ahead. The breath of the pack puffed warm and white from long grey jaws. Ice had frozen between their paws, hard as stone. But the hunt was on now, the prey ahead. Flesh, the warg thought, meat. A man alone was a feeble thing, big and strong with good sharp eyes, but dull of ear and deaf to smells. Deer and elk and even hares were faster, bears and boars fiercer in a fight. But men in packs were dangerous. As the wolves closed on the prey, the warg heard the wailing of a pup, the crust of last night's snow breaking under clumsy man-paws, the rattle of hard skins, and the long grey claws men carried. "Swords," a voice inside him whispered. "Spears." The trees had grown icy teeth, snarling down from the bare brown branches. One eye ripped through the undergrowth, spraying snow. His packmates followed, up a hill and down the slope beyond, until the wood opened before them and the men were there. One was female. The fur-wrapped bundle she clutched was her pup. "Leave her for lust," the voice whispered. "The males are the danger." They were roaring at each other as men did, but the warg could smell their terror. One had a wooden tooth as tall as he was. He flung it, but his hand was shaking, and the tooth sailed high. Then the pack was on them. His one-eyed brother knocked the tooth-thrower back into a snowdrift and tore his throat out as he struggled. His sister slipped behind the other male and took him from the rear. That left the female and her pup for him. She had a tooth, too, a little one made of bone, but she dropped it when the warg's jaws closed around her leg. As she fell, she wrapped both arms around her noisy pup. Underneath her furs, the female was just skin and bones, but her dugs were full of milk. The sweetest meat was on the pup. The wolf saved the choicest parts for his brother. All around the carcasses, the frozen snow turned pink and red as the pack filled its bellies. Leagues away, in a one-room hut of mud and straw, with a thatched roof and a smoke hole, and a floor of hard-packed earth, Varamir shivered and coughed and licked his lips. His eyes were red, his lips cracked, his throat dry and parched, but the taste of blood and fat filled his mouth, even as his swollen belly cried for nourishment. "A child's flesh," he thought, remembering Bump. "Human meat." Had he sunk so low as to hunger after human meat? He could almost hear Hagen growling at him. "Man may eat the flesh of beasts, and beasts the flesh of men, but the man who eats the flesh of man is an abomination." Abomination. That had always been Hagen's favourite word. Abomination, abomination, abomination. To eat of human meat was abomination. To mate as wolf with wolf was abomination. And to seize the body of another man was the worst abomination of all. Hagen was weak, afraid of his own power. He died weeping and alone when I ripped his second life from him. Verimir had devoured his heart himself. He taught me much and more, and the last thing I learned from him was the taste of human flesh. That was as a wolf, though. He had never eaten the meat of man with human teeth. He would not grudge his pack their feast, however. The wolves were as famished as he was, gaunt and cold and hungry, and the prey, two men and a woman, a babe in arms, fleeing from defeat to death. They would have perished soon in any case, from exposure or starvation. This way was better, quicker, a mercy. "A mercy," he said aloud. His throat was raw, but it felt good to hear a human voice, even his own. The air smelled of mould and damp. The ground was cold and hard, and his fire was giving off more smoke than heat. He moved as close to the flames as he dared, coughing and shivering by turns, his side throbbing where his wound had opened. Blood had soaked his breeches to the knee and dried into a hard brown crust. Thistle had warned him that might happen.
"I sewed it up the best I could," she'd said. "But you need to rest and let it mend, or the flesh will tear open again."
Thistle had been the last of his companions, a spear-wife tough as an old root, warty, windburnt and wrinkled. The others had deserted them along the way. One by one they fell behind or forged ahead, making for their old villages, or the milk water, or hard home, or a lonely death in the woods. Faramir did not know and could not care. "I should have taken one of them when I had the chance. One of the twins, or the big man with a scarred face, or the youth with the red hair." He had been afraid, though. One of the others might have realized what was happening. Then they would have turned on him and killed him, and Hagen's words had haunted him. And so the chance had passed. After the battle there had been thousands of them struggling through the forest, hungry, frightened, fleeing the carnage that had descended on them at the wall. Some had talked of returning to the homes that they'd abandoned, others of mounting a second assault upon the gate, but most were lost, with no notion of where to go or what to do. They had escaped the black-cloaked crows and the knights in their grey steel, but more relentless enemies stalked them now. Every day left more corpses by the trails. Some died of hunger, some of cold, some of sickness. Others were slain by those who had been their brothers in arms when they marched south with Mance Raider, the king beyond the wall. "Mance is fallen," the survivors told each other in despairing voices. "Mance is taken. Mance is dead."
"Harm is dead, and Mance is captured. The rest run off and left us,"
Thistle had claimed, as she was sewing up his wound.
"Tormund, the Weeper, Six Skins, all them brave raiders, where are they now?"
"She does not know me," Varamyr realized then. "And why should she?" Without his beasts, he did not look like a great man. "I was Varamyr Six Skins, who broke bread with Mance Raider." He had named himself Varamyr when he was 10. "A name fit for a lord, a name for songs, a mighty name and fearsome." Yet he had run from the crows like a frightened rabbit. The terrible Lord Varamyr had gone craven, but he could not bear that she should know that. So he told the spearwife that his name was Hagen. Afterwards he wondered why that name had come to his lips, of all those he might have chosen. "I ate his heart and drank his blood, and still he haunts me." One day, as they fled, a rider came galloping through the woods on a gaunt white horse, shouting they should all make for the milk water, that the Weeper was gathering warriors to cross the Bridge of Skulls and take the Shadow Tower. Many followed him, more did not. Later a dual warrior in fur and amber went from cookfire to cookfire, urging all the survivors to head north and take refuge in the Valley of the Thens. Why he thought they would be safe there, when the Thens themselves had fled the place, Varamyr never learned, but hundreds followed him. Hundreds more went off with a woods witch, who'd had a vision of a fleet of ships coming to carry the free folk south.
"We must seek the sea," cried Mother Mole,
and her followers turned east. Varamyr might have been amongst them, if only he'd been stronger. The sea was grey and cold and far away, though, and he knew that he would never live to see it. He was 9 times dead and dying, and this would be his true death.
"A squirrel skin cloak," he remembered. "He knifed me for a squirrel skin cloak."
Its owner had been dead, the back of her head smashed into red pulp flecked with bits of bone, but her cloak looked warm and thick. It was snowing, and Varamyr had lost his own cloaks at the wall. His sleeping pelts and woolen small clothes, his sheepskin boots and fur-lined gloves, his store of mead and hoarded food, the hanks of hair he took from the women he bedded, even the golden arm-rings Mance had given him, all lost and left behind.
"I burned, and I died, and then I ran, half-mad with pain and terror."
The memory still shamed him, but he had not been alone. Others had run as well, hundreds of them, thousands. The battle was lost. The knights had come, invincible in their steel, killing everyone who stayed to fight. It was run or die. Death was not so easily outrun, however. So when Varamyr came upon the dead woman in the wood, he knelt to strip the cloak from her, and never saw the boy until he burst from hiding to drive the long bone knife into his side and rip the cloak out of his clutching fingers.
"His mother," Thistle told him later, after the boy had run off. "It were his mother's cloak, and when he saw you rubbing her—"
"She was dead," Varamyr said, wincing as her bone needle pierced his flesh. "Someone smashed her head. Some crow."
"No crow. Hornfoot men, I saw it."
Her needle pulled the gash in his side closed.
"Savages. And who's left to tame them?"
"No one. If Mance is dead, the free folk are doomed. The Thens, giants, and the Hornfoot men, the cave dwellers with their file teeth, and the men of the western shore with their chariots of bone. All of them were doomed as well. Even the crows, they might not know it yet, but those black-cloaked bastards would perish with the rest. The enemy was coming." Hagen's rough voice echoed in his head.
"You will die a dozen deaths, boy, and everyone will hurt, but when your true death comes, you will live again. The second life is simpler and sweeter, they say."
Varamyr Sixskins would know the truth of that soon enough. He could taste his true death in the smoke that hung acrid in the air, feel it in the heat beneath his fingers when he slipped a hand under his clothes to touch his wound. The chill was in him, too, though deep down in his bones. This time it would be cold that killed him. His last death had been by fire. "I burned." At first, in his confusion, he thought some archer on the wall had pierced him with a flaming arrow. But the fire had been inside him, consuming him. And the pain... Varamyr had died 9 times before. He had died once from a spear thrust, once with a bear's teeth in his throat, and once in a wash of blood as he brought forth a stillborn cub. He died his first death when he was only 6, as his father's axe crashed through his skull. Even that had not been so agonizing as the fire in his guts, cracking along his wings, devouring him when he tried to fly from it. His terror fanned the flames and made them burn hotter. One moment he had been soaring above the wall, his eagle's eyes marking the movements of the men below. Then the flames had turned his heart into a blackened cinder and sent his spirit screaming back into his own skin, and for a little while he'd gone mad. Even the memory was enough to make him shudder. That was when he noticed that his fire had gone out. Only a grey and black tangle of charred wood remained, with a few embers glowing in the ashes. "There's still smoke. It just needs wood." Gritting his teeth against the pain, Varamyr crept to the pile of broken branches Thistle had gathered before she went off hunting, and tossed a few sticks onto the ashes. "Catch!" he croaked. "Burn!"
He blew upon the embers and said a wordless prayer to the nameless gods of wood and hill and field. The gods gave no answer. After a while, the smoke ceased to rise as well. Already the little hut was growing colder. Varamyr had no flint, no tinder, no dry kindling. He would never get the fire burning again, not by himself.
"Thistle!"
he called out, his voice hoarse and edged with pain.
"Thistle!"
Her chin was pointed and her nose flat, and she had a mole on one cheek and four dark hairs growing from it. An ugly face and hard, yet he would give much to glimpse it in the door of the hut.
"I should have taken her before she left."
How long had she been gone? 2 days? Three? Varamyr was uncertain. It was dark inside the hut, and he had been drifting in and out of sleep, never quite sure if it was day or night outside.
"Wait," she'd said. "I will be back with food."
So like a fool he'd waited, dreaming of Hagen and Bump and all the wrongs he had done in his long life. But days and nights had passed, and Thistle had not returned.
"She won't be coming back."
Varamyr wondered if he had given himself away. Could she tell what he was thinking just from looking at him? Or had he muttered in his fever dream?
"Abomination," he heard Hagen saying.
It was almost as if he were here, in this very room. "She is just some ugly spearwife," Varamyr told him.
"I am a great man. I am Varamyr, the warg, the skin-changer. It is not right that she should live and I should die."
No one answered. There was no one there. Thistle was gone. She had abandoned him, the same as all the rest. His own mother had abandoned him as well.
"She cried for Bump, but she never cried for me."
The morning his father pulled him out of bed to deliver him to Hagen, she would not even look at him. He had shrieked and kicked as he was dragged into the woods until his father slapped him and told him to be quiet.
"You belong with your own kind," was all he said when he flung him down at Hagen's feet.
Oh, he was not wrong,
Varamyr thought, shivering.
"Hagen taught me much and more. He taught me how to hunt and fish, how to butcher a carcass and bone a fish, how to find my way through the woods. And he taught me the way of the warg and the secrets of the skin-changer, though my gift was stronger than his own."
Years later, he had tried to find his parents, to tell them that their lump had become the great Varamyr Sixskins, but both of them were dead and burned.
"Gone into the trees and streams, gone into the rocks and earth, gone to dirt and ashes."
That was what the woods witch told his mother the day Bump died. Lump did not want to be a clod of earth. The boy had dreamed of a day when bards would sing of his deeds and pretty girls would kiss him.
"When I'm grown, I will be king beyond the wall," Lump had promised himself.
He never had, but he had come close. Varamyr Sixskins was a name men feared. He rode to battle on the back of a snow bear 13 feet tall, kept 3 wolves and a shadow cat in thrall, and sat at the right hand of Mance Raider.
"It was Mance who brought me to this place. I should not have listened. I should have slipped inside my bear and torn him to pieces."
Before Mance, Varamyr Sixskins had been a lord of sorts. He lived alone in a hall of moss and mud and hewn logs that had once been Hagen's, attended by his beasts. 12 villages did him homage in bread and salt and cider, offering him fruit from their orchards and vegetables from their gardens. His meat he got himself. Whenever he desired a woman, he sent his shadow cat to stalk her, and whatever girl he'd cast his eye upon would follow meekly to his bed. Some came weeping, aye, but still they came. Varamyr gave them his seed, took a hank of their hair to remember them by, and sent them back. From time to time some village hero would come with spear in hand to slay the beastling and save a sister or a lover or a daughter. Those he killed, but he never harmed the women.
Some he even blessed with children. Runts, small, puny things like lump, and not one with a gift. Fear drove him to his feet, reeling, holding his side to staunch the seep of blood from his wound. Faramir lurched to the door and swept aside the ragged skin that covered it to face a wall of white. Snow! No wonder it had grown so dark and smoky inside. The falling snow had buried the hut. When Faramir pushed at it, the snow crumbled and gave way, still soft and wet. Outside, the night was white as death. Pale, thin clouds danced attendance on a silver moon, while a thousand stars watched coldly. He could see the humped shapes of other huts buried beneath drifts of snow, and beyond them the pale shadow of a weirwood armoured in ice. To the south and west the hills were a vast white wilderness where nothing moved except the blowing snow.
"Thistle!"
Faramir called feebly, wondering how far she could have gone.
"Thistle! Woman, where are you?"
Far away a wolf gave howl. A shiver went through Faramir. He knew that howl as well as Lump had once known his mother's voice. One Eye. He was the oldest of the three, the biggest, the fiercest. Stalker was leaner, quicker, younger, sly, more cunning. But both went in fear of One Eye. The old wolf was fearless, relentless, savage. Faramir had lost control of his other beasts in the agony of the eagle's death. His shadow cat had raced into the woods, whilst his snow bear turned her claws on those around her, ripping apart four men before falling to a spear. She would have slain Faramir had he come within her reach. The bear hated him, had raged each time he wore her skin or climbed upon her back. His wolves, though, my brothers, my pack. Many a cold night he had slept with his wolves, their shaggy bodies piled up around him to help keep him warm. When I die, they will feast upon my flesh, and leave only bones to greet the thaw come spring. The thought was queerly comforting. His wolves had often foraged for him as they roamed. It seemed only fitting that he should feed them in the end. He might well begin his second life tearing at the warm, dead flesh of his own corpse. Dogs were the easiest beasts to bond with. They lived so close to men that they were almost human. Slipping into a dog's skin was like putting on an old boot, its leather softened by wear. As a boot was shaped to accept a foot, a dog was shaped to accept a collar, even a collar no human eye could see. Wolves were harder. A man might befriend a wolf, even break a wolf, but no man could truly tame a wolf.
"Wolves and women wed for life," Hagen often said. "You take one, that's a marriage. The wolf is part of you from that day on, and you're part of him. Both of you will change."
Other beasts were best left alone, the hunter had declared. Cats were vain and cruel, always ready to turn on you. Elk and deer were prey, wear their skins too long, and even the bravest man became a coward. Bears, boars, badgers, weasels. Hagen did not hold with such.
"Some skins you never want to wear, boy. You won't like what you'd become."
Birds were the worst, to hear him tell it.
"Men were not meant to leave the earth. Spend too much time in the clouds, and you never want to come back down again. I know skin changers who've tried hawks, owls, ravens. Even in their own skins, they sit moony, staring up at the bloody blue."
Not all skin changers felt the same, however. Once, when Lump was 10, Hagen had taken him to a gathering of such. The wargs were the most numerous in that company, the wolf brothers, but the boy had found the others stranger and more fascinating. Borak looked so much like his boar that all he lacked was tusks. Oral had his eagle, Briar her shadow cat. The moment he saw them, Lump wanted a shadow cat of his own. The goat woman, Grisella. None of them had been as strong as Varamir's six skins, though, not even Hagen, tall and grim, with his hands as hard as stone. The hunter died weeping after Faramir took Greyskin from him, driving him out to claim the beast for his own. No second life for you, old man.
Varamir Threeskins, he'd called himself back then. Greyskin made four, though the old wolf was frail and almost toothless, and soon followed Hagen into death. Varamir could take any beast he wanted, bend them to his will, make their flesh his own, dog or wolf, bear or badger.
Thistle, he thought. Hagen would call it an abomination, the blackest sin of all. But Hagen was dead, devoured and burned. Mance would have cursed him as well, but Mance was slain or captured. No one will ever know. I will be Thistle, the spearwife, and Varamir Sixskins will be dead.
His gift would perish with his body, he expected. He would lose his wolves and live out the rest of his days as some scrawny, warty woman. But he would live. If she comes back, if I am still strong enough to take her. A wave of dizziness washed over Varamir. He found himself upon his knees, his hands buried in a snowdrift. He scooped up a fistful of snow and filled his mouth with it, rubbing it through his beard and against his cracked lips, sucking down the moisture. The water was so cold that he could barely bring himself to swallow, and he realized once again how hot he was. The snow melt only made him hungrier. It was food his belly craved, not water. The snow had stopped falling, but the wind was rising, filling the air with crystal, slashing at his face as he struggled through the drifts, the wound in his side opening and closing again. His breath made a ragged white cloud. When he reached the weirwood tree, he found a fallen branch just long enough to use as a crutch. Leaning heavily upon it, he staggered toward the nearest hut. Perhaps the villagers had forgotten something when they fled. A sack of apples, some dried meat, anything to keep him alive until Thistle returned. He was almost there when his crutch snapped beneath his weight, and his legs went out from under him. How long he sprawled there with his blood reddening the snow, Varamir could not have said. The snow will bury me. It would be a peaceful death. They say you feel warm near the end, warm and sleepy. It would be good to feel warm again, though it made him sad to think that he would never see the green lands, the warm lands beyond the wall that Mance used to sing about.
The world beyond the wall is not for our kind, Hagen used to say. The free folk fear skin changers, but they honour us as well. South of the wall, the kneelers hunt us down and butcher us like pigs.
You warned me, Varamir thought, but it was you who showed me Eastwatch too.
He could not have been more than 10. Hagen traded a dozen strings of amber and a sled piled high with pelts for 6 skins of wine, a block of salt, and a copper kettle. Eastwatch was a better place to trade than Castle Black. That was where the ships came, laden with goods from the fabled lands beyond the sea. The crows knew Hagen as a hunter and a friend to the Night's Watch, and welcomed the news he brought of life beyond their wall. Some knew him for a skin-changer, too, but no one spoke of that. It was there at Eastwatch by the sea that the boy he'd been first began to dream of the warm south. Varamir could feel the snowflakes melting on his brow.
This is not so bad as burning. Let me sleep and never wake. Let me begin my second life.
His wolves were close now. He could feel them. He would leave this feeble flesh behind, become one with them, hunting the night and howling at the moon. The warg would become a true wolf.
Which, though?
Not sly. Hagen would have called it abomination. But Varamir had often slipped inside her skin as she was being mounted by One Eye. He did not want to spend his new life as a bitch, though, not unless he had no other choice. Stalker might suit him better, the younger male, though One Eye was larger and fiercer, and it was One Eye who took Sly whenever she went into heat.
"They say you forget,"
Hagen had told him a few weeks before his own death.
"When the man's flesh dies, his spirit lives on inside the beast, but every day his memory fades, and the beast becomes a little less a warg, a little more a wolf, until nothing of the man is left, and only the beast remains.
Vladimir knew the truth of that when he claimed the eagle that had been Oral's. He could feel the other skin changer raging at his presence. Oral had been slain by the turncloak crow Jon Snow, and his hate for his killer had been so strong that Vladimir found himself hating the beastly boy as well. He had known what Snow was the moment he saw that great white direwolf stalking silent at his side. One skin changer can always sense another.
Mant should have let me take the direwolf. There would be a second life worthy of a king.
He could have done it, he did not doubt. The gift was strong in Snow, but the youth was untaught, still fighting his nature when he should have gloried in it. Vladimir could see the weirwood's red eyes staring down at him from the white trunk.
The gods are weighing me.
A shiver went through him. He had done bad things, terrible things. He had stolen, killed, raped. He had gorged on human flesh and lapped the blood of dying men as it gushed red and hot from their torn throats. He had stalked foes through the woods, fallen on them as they slept, clawed their entrails from their bellies and scattered them across the muddy earth.
How sweet their meat had tasted! That was the beast, not me, he said in a hoarse whisper. That was the gift you gave me.
The guards made no reply. His breath hung pale and misty in the air. He could feel ice forming in his beard. Vladimir's six skins closed his eyes. He dreamt an old dream of a hovel by the sea, three dogs whimpering, a woman's tears.
Bump! She weeps for Bump, but she never wept for me.
Lump had been born a month before his proper time, and he was sick so often that no one expected him to live. His mother waited until he was almost four to give him a proper name, and by then it was too late. The whole village had taken to calling him Lump. The name his sister, Miha, had given him when he was still in their mother's belly. Miha had given Bump his name as well, but Lump's little brother had been born in his proper time, big and red and robust, sucking greedily at mother's teats. She was going to name him after father.
Bump died, though. He died when he was two, and I was six, 3 days before his name day.
Your little one is with the guards now,
the woods witch told his mother as she wept.
He'll never hurt again, never hunger, never cry. The guards have taken him down into the earth, into the trees. The guards are all around us, in the rocks and streams, in the birds and beasts. Your Bump has gone to join them. He'll be the world and all that's in it.
The old woman's words had gone through Lump like a knife.
Bump sees. He's watching me. He knows.
Lump could not hide from him, could not slip behind his mother's skirts, or run off with the dogs to escape his father's fury. The dogs, Loptail, Sniff, the growler, they were good dogs. They were my friends. When his father found the dog sniffing around Bump's body, he had no way of knowing which had done it, so he took his axe to all three. His hand shook so badly that it took two blows to silence Sniff and four to put the growler down. The smell of blood hung heavy in the air, and the sounds the dying dogs had made were terrible to hear. Yet Loptail still came when father called him. He was the oldest dog, and his training overcame his terror. By the time Lump slipped inside his skin, it was too late.
No, father, please, he tried to say, but dogs cannot speak the tongues of men,
so all that emerged was a piteous whine. The axe crashed into the middle of the old dog's skull, and inside the hovel the boy let out a scream.
That was how they knew.
2 days later, his father dragged him into the woods. He brought his axe. So Lump thought he meant to put him down the same way he had done the dogs. Instead, he'd given him to Hagen. Vladimir woke suddenly, violently, his whole body shaking.
"Get up!" a voice was screaming. "Get up! We have to go! There are hundreds of them!"
The snow had covered him with a stiff white blanket.
"So cold!"
When he tried to move, he found that his hand was frozen to the ground. He left some skin behind when he tore it loose.
"Get up!"
she screamed again.
"They're coming!"
Thistle had returned to him. She had him by the shoulders, and she was shaking him, shouting in his face. Faramir could smell her breath and feel the warmth of it upon cheeks gone numb with cold.
"No," he thought. "Do it now, or die."
He summoned all the strength still in him, leapt out of his own skin, and forced himself inside her. Thistle arched her back and screamed, "Abomination!" Was that her, or him, or Hagen? He never knew. His old flesh fell back into the snowdrift as her fingers loosened. The spear wife twisted violently, shrieking. His shadow cat used to fight him wildly, and the snow bear had gone half mad for a time, snapping at trees and rocks and empty air. But this was worse.
"Get out! Get out!"
he heard her own mouth shouting. Her body staggered, fell, and rose again. Her hands flailed, her legs jerked this way and that in some grotesque dance, as his spirit and her own fought for the flesh. She sucked down a mouthful of the frigid air, and Faramir had half a heartbeat to glory in the taste of it and the strength of this young body before her teeth snapped together and filled his mouth with blood. She raised her hands to his face. He tried to push them down again, but the hands would not obey, and she was clawing at his eyes. "Abomination," he remembered, drowning in blood and pain and madness. When he tried to scream, she spat their tongue out. The white world turned and fell away. For a moment it was as if he were inside the weirwood, gazing out through carved red eyes as a dying man twitched feebly on the ground and a madwoman danced blind and bloody underneath the moon, weeping red tears and ripping at her clothes. Then both were gone, and he was rising, melting, his spirit borne on some cold wind. He was in the snow and in the clouds. He was a sparrow, a squirrel, an oak. A horned owl flew silently between his trees, hunting a hare. Faramir was inside the owl, inside the hare, inside the trees. Deep below the frozen ground, earthworms burrowed blindly in the dark, and he was them as well.
"I am the wood and everything that's in it," he thought, exulting.
100 ravens took to the air, cawing as they felt him pass. A great elk trumpeted, unsettling the children clinging to his back. A sleeping direwolf raised his head to snarl at empty air. Before their hearts could beat again, he had passed on, searching for his own, for One Eye, Sly, and Stalker, for Pack. His wolves would save him, he told himself. That was his last thought, as a man. True death came suddenly. He felt a shock of cold, as if he had been plunged into the icy waters of a frozen lake. Then he found himself rushing over moonlit snows with his packmates close behind him. Half the world was dark. One Eye, he knew. He bayed, and Sly and Stalker gave echo. When they reached the crest, the wolves paused. Thistle, he remembered, and a part of him grieved for what he had lost, and another part for what he'd done. Below, the world had turned to ice. Fingers of frost crept slowly up the weirwood, reaching out for each other. The empty village was no longer empty. Blue-eyed shadows walked amongst the mounds of snow. Some wore brown and some wore black, and some were naked, their flesh gone white as snow. A wind was sighing through the hills, heavy with their scents. Dead flesh, dry blood, skins that stank of mold, and rot and urine. Sly gave a growl and bared her teeth, her ruff bristling.
"Not men, not prey, not these."
The things below moved, but did not live. One by one they raised their heads, toward the three wolves on the hill. The last look was the thing that had been Thistle. She wore wool and fur and leather, and over that she wore a coat of hoarfrost that crackled when she moved and glistened in the moonlight. Pale pink icicles hung from her fingertips, 10 long knives of frozen blood, and in the pits where her eyes had been, a pale blue light was flickering, lending her coarse features an eerie beauty they had never known in life. "Oh, she sees me!" Tyrion. He drank his way across the narrow sea. The ship was small, his cabin smaller, but the captain would not allow him above decks. The rocking of the deck beneath his feet made his stomach heave, and the wretched food tasted even worse when wrenched back up. But why did he need salt beef, hard cheese, and bread crawling with worms when he had wine to nourish him? It was red and sour, very strong. Sometimes he heaved the wine up too, but there was always more. "Oh, the world is full of wine," he muttered in the darkness of his cabin. His father never had any use for drunkards, but what did that matter? His father was dead. He'd killed him. "A bolt in the belly, my lord, and all for you. If only I was better with a crossbow, I would have put it through that cock you made me with, you bloody bastard." Below decks it was neither night nor day. Tyrion marked time by the comings and goings of the cabin boy, who brought the meals he did not eat. The boy always brought a brush and bucket, too, to clean up. "Is this Dornish wine?" Tyrion asked him once, as he pulled a stopper from his skin. "It reminds me of a certain snake I knew, a droll fellow, till a mountain fell on him." The cabin boy did not answer. He was an ugly boy, though admittedly more comely than a certain dwarf, with half a nose and a scar from eye to chin. "Have I offended you?" Tyrion asked, as the boy was scrubbing. "Were you commanded not to talk to me? Or did some dwarf diddle your mother?" That went unanswered, too. "Where are we sailing? Tell me that." Jamie had made mention of the free cities, but had never said which one. "Is it Braavos, Tyrosh, Mir?" Tyrion would soon have gone to Dorne. "Marcella is older than Tommen. By Dornish law, the Iron Throne is hers. I will help her claim her rights, as Prince Oberyn suggested." Oberyn was dead, though, his head smashed a bloody ruin by the armored fist of Sir Gregor Clegane. And without the Red Viper to urge him on, would Durin Martell even consider such a chancy scheme? "He might clap me in chains instead, and hand me back to my sweet sister." The wall might be safer. Old Bear Mormont said the Night's Watch had need of men like Tyrion. "Mormont might be dead, though. By now Slint may be the Lord Commander." That butcher's son was not like to have forgotten who sent him to the wall. "Do I really want to spend the rest of my life eating salt beef and porridge with murderers and thieves?" Not that the rest of his life would last very long. Janus Slint would see to that. The cabin boy wet his brush and scrubbed on manfully. "Have you ever visited the pleasure houses of lice?" the dwarf inquired. "Might that be where whores go?" Tyrion could not seem to recall the Valyrian word for whore. In any case, it was too late. The boy tossed his brush back in his bucket and took his leave. "The wine has blurred my wits." He had learned to read High Valyrian at his maester's knee, though what they spoke in the Nine Free Cities, well, it was not so much a dialect as nine dialects on the way to becoming separate tongues. Tyrion had some Braavosi and a smattering of Mirish. In Tyrosh he should be able to curse the gods, call a man a cheat, and order up an ale, thanks to a sellsword he had once known at the Rock. At least in Dorne they speak the common tongue, like Dornish food and Dornish law. Dornish speech was spiced with the flavors of the Rhoyne, but a man could comprehend it. "Dorne, yes, Dorne for me." He crawled into his bunk, clutching that thought like a child with a doll. Sleep had never come easily to Tyrion Lannister. Aboard that ship, it seldom came at all, though from time to time he managed to drink sufficient wine to pass out for a while. At least he did not dream. He had dreamt enough for one small life, and of such follies, love, justice, friendship, glory, as well dream of being tall. It was all beyond his reach, Tyrion knew now, but he did not know where whores go. "Wherever whores go," his father had said, his last words, and what words they were. The crossbow thrummed. Lord Tywin sat back down, and Tyrion Lannister found himself waddling through the darkness with Varys at his side. He must have clambered back down the shaft, 230 rungs, to where orange embers glowed in the mouth of an iron dragon. He remembered none of it, only the sound the crossbow made and the stink of his father's bowels opening. "Even in his dying, he found a way to shit on me." Varys had escorted him through the tunnels, but they never spoke until they emerged beside the Blackwater, where Tyrion had won a famous victory and lost a nose. That was when the dwarf turned to the eunuch and said, "I've killed my father," in the same tone a man might use to say, "I've stubbed my toe." The Master of Whisperers had been dressed as a begging brother, in a moth-eaten robe of brown rough spun, with a cowl that shadowed his smooth fat cheeks and bald round head. "You should not have climbed that ladder," he said reproachfully. "Wherever oars go," Tyrion warned his father not to say that word. "If I had not loosed, he would have seen my threats were empty. He would have taken the crossbow for my hands, as once he took Tysha for my arms. He was rising when I killed him." "I killed Shae too," he confessed to Varys. "You knew what she was." "I did, but I never knew what he was." Varys tittered. "And now you do." "I should have killed the eunuch as well. A little more blood in his hands, what would it matter?" He could not say what had stayed his dagger, not gratitude. Varys had saved him from a headsman's sword, but only because Jaime had compelled him. "Jaime. No, better not to think of Jaime." He found a fresh skin of wine instead, and sucked at it as if it were a woman's breast. The sour red ran down his chin and soaked through his soiled tunic, the same one he had been wearing in his cell. The deck was swaying beneath his feet, and when he tried to rise, it lifted sideways and smashed him hard against a bulkhead. "A storm," he realized, "or else I'm even drunker than I knew." He retched the wine up and lay in it a while, wondering if the ship would sink. "Is this your vengeance, father? Has the Father above made you his hand? Such are the wages of the kinslayer," he said as the wind howled outside. It did not seem fair to drown the cabin boy and the captain and all the rest for something he had done. But when had the guards ever been fair? And round about then, the darkness gulped him down. When he stirred again, his head felt like to burst, and the ship was spinning round in dizzy circles, though the captain was insisting that they'd come to port. Tyrion told him to be quiet, and kicked feebly as a huge bald sailor tucked him under one arm and carried him squirming to the hold where an empty wine cask awaited him. It was a squat little cask, and a tight fit even for a dwarf. Tyrion pissed himself in his struggles, for all the good it did. He was crammed face first into the cask, with his knees pushed up against his ears. The stub of his nose itched horribly, but his arms were pinned so tightly that he could not reach to scratch it. "A palanquin fit for a man of my stature," he thought, as they hammered shut the lid. He could hear voices shouting as he was hoisted up. Every bounce cracked his head against the bottom of the cask. The whirl went round and round as the cask rolled downwards, then stopped with a crash that made him want to scream. Another cask slammed into his, and Tyrion bit his tongue. That was the longest journey he'd ever taken, though it could not have lasted more than half an hour. He was lifted and lowered, rolled and stacked, upended and righted, and rolled again. Through the wooden staves he heard men shouting, and once a horse whickered nearby. His stunted legs began to cramp, and soon hurt so badly that he forgot the hammering in his head. It ended as it had begun, with another roll that left him dizzy and more jouncy. Outside, strange voices were speaking in a tongue he did not know. Someone started pounding on the top of the cask, and the lid cracked open suddenly. Light came flooding in, and cool air as well. Tyrion gasped greedily and tried to stand, but only managed to knock the cask over sideways and spill himself out onto a hard-packed earthen floor. Above him loomed a grotesque fat man with a forked yellow beard, holding a wooden mallet and an iron chisel. His bedroom was large enough to serve as a tawny pavilion, but its loosely knotted belt had come undone, exposing a huge white belly and a pair of heavy breasts that sagged like sacks of suet covered with coarse yellow hair. He reminded Tyrion of a dead sea cow that had once washed up in the caverns under Casterly Rock. The fat man looked down and smiled. "A drunken dwarf," he said, in the common tongue of Westeros. "A rutting sea-cow!" Tyrion's mouth was full of blood. He spat it at the fat man's feet. They were in a long, dim cellar with barrel-vaulted ceilings, its stone walls spotted with nitre. Casks of wine and ale surrounded them. More than enough drink to see a thirsty dwarf safely through the night. Or through a life?
You are insolent, I like that, in a dwarf.
When the fat man laughed, his flesh bounced so vigorously that Tyrion was afraid he might fall and crush him.
Are you hungry, my little friend? Weary?
Thirsty? Tyrion struggled to his knees. And filthy? The fat man sniffed.
A bath first, just so. Then food and a soft bed, yes. My servants shall see to it.
His host put the mallet and chisel aside.
My house is yours. Any friend of my friend across the water is a friend of Illyrio Mopatis, yes.
And any friend of Varys the Spider is someone I will trust just as far as I can throw him. The fat man made good on the promised bath, though. No sooner did Tyrion lower himself into the hot water and close his eyes than he was fast asleep. He woke naked on a goose-down feather bed so soft it felt as if he'd been swallowed by a cloud. His tongue was growing hair, and his throat was raw, but his cock was as hard as an iron bar. He rolled from the bed, found a chamber pot, and commenced to filling it with a groan of pleasure. The room was dim, but there were bars of yellow sunlight showing between the slats of the shutters. Tyrion shook the last drops off and waddled over patterned mirish carpets as soft as new spring grass. Awkwardly he climbed the window seat and flung shutters open to see where Varys and the guards had sent him. Beneath his window, six cherry trees stood sentinel around a marble pool, their slender branches bare and brown. A naked boy stood on the water, poised to duel with a bravo's blade in hand. He was lithe and handsome, no older than 16, with straight blonde hair that brushed his shoulders. So lifelike did he seem that it took the dwarf a long moment to realize he was made of painted marble, though his sword shimmered like true steel. Across the pool stood a brick wall, 12 feet high, with iron spikes along its top. Beyond that was the city, a sea of tiled rooftops crowded close around a bay. He saw square brick towers, a great red temple, a distant manse upon a hill. In the far distance, sunlight shimmered off deep water. Fishing boats were moving across the bay, their sails rippling in the wind, and he could see the masts of larger ships poking up along the shore. Surely one is bound for Dawn, or for Eastwatch by the sea? He had no means to pay for passage, though, nor was he made to pull an oar.
I suppose I could sign on as a cabin boy and earn my way by letting the crew bugger me up and down the narrow sea. He wondered where he was. Even the air smells different here. Strange spices scented the chilly autumn wind, and he could hear faint cries drifting over the wall from the streets beyond. It sounded something like Valerian, but he did not recognize more than one word in five. "Not Bravos," he continued, "nor Tyrosh. Those bare branches and the chill in the air argued against Lice and Mir and Valantis as well."
When he heard the door opening behind him, Tyrion turned to confront his fat host.
"This is Pentos, yes?"
"Just so. Where else?"
"Pentos? Well, it was not King's Landing. That much could be said for it. Where do whores go?" he heard himself ask.
"Whores are found in brothels here, as in Westeros. You will have no need of such, my little friend. Choose from amongst my serving women. No one will dare refuse you."
"Slaves?" the dwarf asked pointedly. The fat man stroked one of the prongs of his oiled yellow beard, a gesture Tyrion found remarkably obscene.
"Slavery is forbidden in Pentos by the terms of the treaty the Bravassi imposed on us 100 years ago. Still, they will not refuse you."
Illyrio gave a ponderous half-bow.
"But now my little friend must excuse me. I have the honour to be magister of this great city, and the prince has summoned us to session."
He smiled, showing a mouthful of crooked yellow teeth.
"Explore the manse and grounds as you like, but on no account stray beyond the walls. It is best that no man knows that you were here."
"Were? Have I gone somewhere?"
"Time enough to speak of that this evening. My little friend and I shall eat and drink and make great plans, yes?"
"Yes, my fat friend," Tyrion replied. "He thinks to use me for his profit." It was all profit with the merchant princes of the free cities.
"Spice, soldiers, and cheese lords,"
his lord father called them with contempt. Should a day ever dawn when Illyrio Mopatis saw more profit in a dead dwarf than a live one, Tyrion would find himself packed into another wine cask by dusk. "It would be well if I were gone before that day arrives." That it would arrive, he did not doubt. Cersei was not like to forget him, and even Jaime might be vexed to find a quarrel in father's belly. A light wind was riffling the waters of the pool below, all around the naked swordsman. It reminded him of how Tysha would riffle his hair during the fourth spring of their marriage, before he helped his father's guardsmen rape her. He had been thinking of those guardsmen during his flight, trying to recall how many there had been. You would think he might remember that, but no. A dozen, a score, 100, he could not say. They had all been grown men, tall and strong. Though all men were tall to a dwarf of 13 years. Tysha knew their number. Each of them had given her a silver stag, so she would only need to count the coins. "A silver for each, and a gold for me." His father had insisted that he pay her too. "A Lannister always pays his debts."
"Whatever oars go," he heard Lord Tywin say once more,
and once more the bowstrings thrummed. The magister had invited him to explore the manse. He found clean clothes in a cedar chest, inlaid with lapis and mother-of-pearl. The clothes had been made for a small boy, he realized as he struggled into them. The fabrics were rich enough, if a little musty, but the cut was too long in the legs and too short in the arms, with a collar that would have turned his face as black as Joffrey's had he somehow contrived to get it fastened. Moths had been at them, too. At least they do not stink of vomit. Tyrion began his explorations with the kitchen, where two fat women and a potboy watched him warily as he helped himself to cheese, bread, and figs.
"Good morrow to you, fair ladies," he said with a bow. "Do you know where oars go?"
When they did not respond, he repeated the question in High Valyrian,
though he had to say courtesan in place of whore. The younger, fatter cook gave him a shrug that time.